been on calls before, I believe. I recognize your name.
Yes, I have.
I am Sally.
Hi, Sally.
And
I'm going to go ahead and mute myself.
Okay.
Okay, mute.
Hi, who's there?
Hi, this is Linda Chapman in North Carolina.
Hi, Linda. We're going to try tonight to have more full introductions, but we're going to do it at the end of the call. We're going to try to be finished at 10 of 10 and hope that people will stay on and kind of say a little bit about their own local work, maybe, you know, anti-war work. So you might be thinking about...
Hey.
Hi, who's there?
Lois Hamilton
hey,
in Santa
Lois.
Barbara, California. Hi.
Hi, Lois.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good.
We've kind of let up on Lois Capps right now.
You
only
have.
Because she's got Abel Maldonado to, she's got a tough race.
Oh.
And we need to keep her in the house, so. Anyway.
Yep. Hi, well, two or three people just came on. Could you say your name?
Hi, I'm Kate Walsh from Chicago.
Hi, Kate. This is from the UFPJ Afghanistan Working Group.
Yes.
Kate. So Kate and I are both.
Mike Fox, St. Petersburg.
Who's that?
Mike Fox in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Never heard of you. Hi, Mike. Who else came on?
Rich Gardner, Philadelphia.
All right, Rich. Things going okay there? Tech-wise?
Yep.
Good. All right. Well, there's quite a few people registered for the call. So you're probably in various time zones. Dinner could be happening some places. So here in the East, we eat dinner, and then we twiddle our thumbs for a while and wait for 9 o'clock to come. And it's dark now. No, it's been dark a while. So definitely the days are shorter.
Yes.
Hi, who's there?
Hi, it's Mark Levin.
Hey, Mark.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty good.
Edwina.
Hi, Edwina. Hi, we're going to have extended introductions at the end of the call tonight, hoping that people will give a little report maybe on what their local group does. Hello, who's there? For one thing, we're waiting for our speaker to come on the call. Hello?
Hello, this is Kay Vanderseel.
Hi.
Hello, this is Meg Whitaker Green.
Hi. Coming in good.
And Chuck Altman.
Anyone else? Our speaker teaches a class until 9 o'clock. And that's in Miami, Sandy?
Oh, no, I think it's in Washington.
Oh, in Washington. He's going to be calling in from D.C., I see. And so we know he may not be able to be on quite at 9 because, you know, things happen. So we're not saying much about, you know, we're not asking you much about where you live or anything tonight because we're hoping that at 10 of 10 Eastern, at 10 of the hour, we will try to have you introduce yourself to all of us, you know, to say what maybe a little why you're on the call tonight, but mostly what do you do locally and especially the anniversary is coming up of the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, let's say. Or maybe it'll come out of the call tonight, you'll want to say something. Okay, anyone else come on?
Hi, Sally, Russell Green.
Russell Green, hi.
How are you? Hi.
Hi, Russell.
Hi.
Hi, we're waiting for the magic name of Ray McGovern to pop up.
Rich, do you want to tell people how to get on into our chat room?
Sure. If you go to pdacommunity.org, then get on to the issues tag.
So what is it again? I couldn't hear it.
PDAcommunity.org.
Oh, PDA Community. Okay.
Okay, and then the second category heading is called Issues.
Uh-huh.
And then you click on that, and that gets you to End War and Occupation. And, sorry, I just have to get back to it here. Once you're on there, you then, there we go. It's taking a long time to come up. You're going to the right-hand side of the screen. There starts the Join Change Issue Team and War and Occupation Leadership. Issue Team calls, a lengthy agenda, and then under that is the chat room. And we have a couple guests on there already. About five are online so far.
Right, and that's a good place to ask a question. If you put your question in there, I will be sure to ask it of Ray McGovern, of our speaker. Keep an eye on that. Or you can unmute when we get to the question section and ask the question. So
does anyone need Rich to go through any part of that again? It's a good little device, the chat room. Oh, we're still waiting for Ray McGovern to come on, I think, as far as I know. So I will give the commercial now. Right above the chat room, if you happen to be there, or in other parts of the website, if you're on the main page of PDA, not even tonight, but some other time, there's a donate button, as all organizations have. And, you know, even these calls cost us something, not a huge amount, but certainly national staff likes to be paid. I think there's a national staff member on here tonight. His name is Mike Fox. And Virginia and I are strictly volunteer. And there's a lot of expenses. We just had in Charlotte, you may already know that the PDA ran a sort of a people's convention. In a separate location from the Democratic National Convention, and had several of our congressmen that we work with closely, and other people that are very closely tied to PDA in the expert world, I think there were at least 90 delegates to the convention that made their way there, and altogether I think 300 people were there in the audience, and pretty soon we'll be able to put out so that you can see it. It was video streamed live, but it was, you know, it was a Tuesday, and most people couldn't watch it live, so it's being put in a YouTube form, and it will be available, I don't know, any day now, and I'm sure there'll be some sort of blast that'll go out to everybody to tell them about that. So, Ray McGovern, did you sneak on? Okay. Maybe if he's using a cell phone or something like that, he may be finding that the cell phone tower is not quite
Sally,
where he hoped
this
would be or something.
This is Sandy. I'll just get off the call and give Ray a call and
that's
just
a good
just
idea.
Make sure everything's okay.
There's a lot of funny noise in the background.
Yes. Well, I guess most people should
star six
mute themselves. Somebody just star fixed, and that helped. Thank you. Oh, no, it's back. It's back. Star 6 mutes you, and then star 6 unmutes you. So even if you have something to say right now, you can see we're sort of filling in right now. So if you want to say something or ask something, until Ray comes, we really won't get started. And Sandy is the person who just said they were going to call Ray is named Sandy Davies. And he's a published author on subjects of anti-war, specifically Iraq. And he will be sort of guiding the discussion of Ray McGovern tonight. So sometimes we have found that our speakers sort of maybe they put the number of the call in their pocket, but maybe they wore a different shirt or something. So it sometimes at least once happened where the speaker didn't know how to access the call. And Sandy Davies that I was just bragging about because we all work with him. There are five people in the leadership of this call. And you hear Virginia every month. Hear me too long right now. My husband Carl and Mark Levin. Sandy.
This is Lois in Santa Barbara.
Yes, Lois.
I just want to say how much are we going to do to go against Obama's drone warfare in this election year? That's in this election, two months from now. That's my big problem right now.
Well,
how much are we going to what?
Go against Obama's drone warfare policy, which we all object to.
Yeah. I would say take that up with Kim Carpenter directly. I know some of the answer to that.
Hi, someone from San Diego.
Hi, who's coming on?
John from San Diego. Oh. I was running a little late.
Hi.
Winnie Foster in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Hi, Winnie. Was there one more ding? Yeah, please, everybody, mute by pressing R6 on your phone.
I think it might be your phone, Sally.
It could be.
Yeah, there's a really funny thing going on in the background.
Yeah, okay.
Hard for us to hear you, Sally.
All right, well, I'm Virginia Hoffler, and my co-coordinator is Sally Weiss, who has been speaking to you up to now. We're waiting for Ray McGovern to get on the phone. Sandy Davies is our foreign policy guru, and he's going to introduce him. Hello? Who just came on?
This is Sandy. I just came back on.
Okay. Are you able to reach him?
Yes. So is it Ray McGovern? Are you on there?
Is that Ray?
Hi, it's Ray. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. And I was about to introduce you, Sandy. So with no further ado, Sandy Davies, author of Blood on Our Hands and our foreign policy guru. Take it away.
Yeah. Well, good evening, everybody. We're very fortunate tonight to have Ray McGovern with us. Ray McGovern, for those of you who don't know, worked as a CIA analyst for most of his life under seven different administrations, from the Kennedy administration through the Bush 1 administration. Towards the end of his career, he was a senior analyst conducting presidential daily briefs and chairing national intelligence efforts.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but if there's something going on with this call, they can't let us hear you. There's all this background noise. Somebody speaking in the background.
Yeah, would everybody that's not, maybe everyone except for me and Ray and maybe Sally and Virginia, please mute your phone. You press star 6, and that should mute your phone, and that should eliminate the background noise. Okay, we're still getting some interference here. Does everyone have their phone muted?
Sandy, I start 6 the thing, but I'm still getting a lot of interference.
Yeah, well, we don't want you to mute, Ray, because you're going to be talking.
Okay.
We want everyone else to mute their phone.
How do I unmute?
Yeah, and you press star 6. Well, I can hear you, so I don't think you're muted right now. Okay. So let's try and go ahead. I think that's sounding a bit better now. So as I said, after Ray retired from the CIA, he has become, I would say, an intelligence analyst for the people and for the peace movement. He founded a group called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and has really stood up at times to challenge, amongst others, Donald Rumsfeld and Hillary Clinton in public fora about U.S. foreign policy. He's now very concerned about the danger of a new U.S. war against Iran, and that's what he's come on tonight to talk to us about. So without further ado, let me hand it over to you, Ray.
Thanks, Nick. Well, there's a lot to be said here, but I would hope that we could have a dialogue more than a lecture, certainly from my part. I'm a little disturbed at the feedback I'm getting on this call, so if anyone's also experiencing this problem, perhaps they can indicate that in some way or another. So let me just set the stage here. We have, 8 or 9 weeks before the election. The way that I've been approaching this has been to try to rise above the Tuesday, Israel's going to attack. Wednesday, no, it doesn't look like they're going to attack. Thursday, but Netanyahu says they're going to attack. Friday, no, the White House says it shouldn't happen. In other words, the play-by-play is deliberately, intentionally confusing. And so I think that the best approach is to look at the equities as seen from Netanyahu's point of view and from Obama's point of view, and the point of view, in Obama's case, of his military leaders, and in Netanyahu's case, his military, intelligence, and political leaders. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that Netanyahu would like to strike Iran before the presidential election on the 6th of November. Why? Well, if I were Netanyahu, I think I would consider that my last best chance to bloody the noses of the Iranians and sort of mousetrap the U.S. into supporting Israel, because the way he looks at Obama, Obama would have no realistic option other than to jump in with both feet if there was an armed clash with Iran. Now, his security and military advisors are very divided on this, and many of them have been very vocal, atypically so, vocal in public about this not being a good idea at all. Now, you can look at that in two ways. One is, well, he probably won't try it if all those people are objecting. The other way to look at it is that, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And unless you're willing to accept the notion that this whole thing is a charade and that Netanyahu has sort of orchestrated this this grand deception where all these people are sort of feigning opposition, but that he's going to go ahead anyway, then, you know, I think you have to take seriously the possibility that he will strike out at Iran between now and the election. Now, how would he do that? Well, False Flag is my candidate for the option. You probably remember that Cy Hirsch reported way back several years ago that Dick Cheney had proposals to paint PT or speedboats in Iranian colors and, you know, have them take a couple of pot shots at U.S. destroyer escorts or whatever in the Gulf and start a dust up that way. That still is, I think, the way this kind of thing would start. Now, one problem or one addition on that is simply that there is no way that the U.S. Navy can communicate directly with their Iranian counterparts in the Gulf or anywhere near the Gulf. Now, one of the admirals, what was his name? Griff was part of it. Cosgriff, yeah. He was the commanding naval officer during the, remember that incident about 2 or 3 years ago where a swarm of Iranian PT boats sort of dropped fake mines and sort of harassed the U.S. Ships. Well, Cosgriff complained to one of my colleagues in Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity that he had no way to communicate with the Iranians. Hand signals was what they were reduced to. He did, of course, go back to Naval Headquarters. They went back to Washington. The Defense Department went to the State Department, and the State Department said, "Oh, thanks very much, but we don't have any way of communicating with the Iranians." We could go through the Swiss Embassy, I suppose, but you want an immediate answer, right? Well, so that's a real problem, and it was recognized as such by Admiral Mike Mullen a couple of times. And the last significant thing he said before he retired at this time last year was, look, we don't talk with the Iranians. There's no way that an incident that happens in the Persian Gulf will be able to be handled reasonably. We don't talk to each other, and things are going to get out of hand very quickly, and we're going to make mistakes, and it's going to be very bad. So spoke the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen. So where does that stand? Well, finally, the Pentagon got its act together, and 2.5 months ago, they delivered a proposal to the Senate Armed Services Committee, a proposal that amounted to a hotline, a incidents at sea agreement, or whatever measures might be taken so that there'd be a fail-safe measure in there to prevent miscalculation or accident or, worse still, provocation, false flag stuff. Now, what happened to that initiative? Well, that initiative remains in the inbox of Senator Carl Levin, who's head of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He is ably assisted, I make a joke, by Lieberman, by Lindsey Graham, and by McCain, all three of them devoted as much to Israel as they are to these United States of America. I mince no words on that. Now, how about Levin? Well, you know, he used to seem like a pretty reasonable guy, but guess what? Of all the senators and all the representatives in our Congress, the person who comes out top in getting funding from AIPAC-supported or AIPAC-related groups is none other than Senator Carl Levin of Michigan. So he's head and shoulders above everybody else. Part of that, of course, has to do with his longevity, how long he's been in place, but nobody points that out. I can only conclude that Senator Carl Levin and Lindsey Graham and McCain and Lieberman would just as soon have a war with Iran. Now, that's not a stretch if you look at things that they've said in the past. So where we stand right now is in my view, Obama clearly doesn't want a war with Iran. Netanyahu can only conclude from his experience with Obama that Obama is, well, how shall I, the way we would put it in the Bronx is he's a wuss, okay? He can be had. He says, Bibi, please stop building new settlements. They're really not quite legal in the West Bank. What does Bibi do? Well, he puts his right thumb on his nose and wiggles the rest of his fingers. Obama says, well, you know, let's go back to what everybody agrees on, the 67 borders with minor adjustments. Bibi puts his right thumb on his nose and wiggles his fingers. And goes to Congress and gets more standing ovations than Obama. So, in my view, Netanyahu thinks that he's in the catbird seat. I'm afraid that he's convinced, no matter what Obama does in terms of sending his minions to Tel Aviv, bear in mind that in the last 6 weeks, Obama has sent his Secretary of State, his Secretary of Defense, his National Security Advisor, the Deputy Secretary of State, and the counterterrorism fellow, Brennan, all within the space of 4 weeks to Tel Aviv. What are they doing? Well, I think they're saying, oh, please, please, Bibi, please, whatever you do, please wait until after the election. Please don't do it. Please don't attack Iran. Please don't provoke an incident, okay? Now, what is... If you were Bibi, if you were Netanyahu, and you sit back and look at this, you know, who remembers that wonderful thing from Longfellow, you know? Speak for yourself, John. Yeah, speak for yourself, Barack, for God's sake. You know, sending all your little lieutenants over here to tell me privately not to attack you. Why are you so afraid to get up and make a speech and say, look, if Netanyahu and Ehud Barak attack Iran, we will not automatically come to their assistance. Now, why don't you do that? He won't do it. He won't do it for obvious reasons. And my point is, how does that play with Netanyahu? If Obama is not willing to do that, if he's not willing to speak out publicly to prevent this kind of raid, what are the chances that he would be able to resist the immediate calls for full U.S. involvement in defense of Israeli forces when they, quote, come under attack, end quote, by the Iranians? So the way I come at this is in a kind of holistic getting away from the day-to-day stuff. And I think it's a good sign. It's surely a good sign that Dempsey said a week ago, look, I don't want to be complicit in an Israeli attack on Iran. That's strong stuff. But you know what? I'm not sure that Obama wanted him to say that. I think it's equally possible that Dempsey is speaking for the military in this case. He wants to lay down the record that, look, I'm very reluctant to send U.S. forces into a war with Iran for obvious reasons, okay? So that's one thing. Maybe it's a good sign, but equally possible it could be a bad sign. Now, the news today, and I only have this from the radio, is that when Netanyahu comes here for the UN, his UN speech later this month, that the White House has said, well, Barack Obama is too busy to meet with Bibi Netanyahu. Wow. Well, that's a positive sign. I mean, that's much bigger than whatever General Dempsey says. So I think things are clarifying to the point where even though Obama is not able politically to say outright, look, if Israel strikes Iran, don't count on us automatically, even though he's not able to say that, I think by now, with Dempsey saying what he did and now the White House turning down, can you imagine, turning down a meeting with the Prime Minister of Israel, that the signals are clear enough to Israel and to the ones that are opposing what Netanyahu and Ehud Barak want to do, that I'm feeling a little bit more comfortable that there won't be a war before the election. But just to finish up here, the incentive here has to do with Israel preventing a second-term Democratic president who might feel free to put the pressure on Israel to do the right thing with respect to the Palestinians, and might feel even more free to warn the Israelis not to get into a shooting war with Iran. That would be the death knell in Bibi Netanyahu's perspective. And he needs the U.S. more than ever before, because in a very real sense, and don't believe me on this, believe Meir Dagan, the former Mossad director, who said Israel today is in its most precarious strategic situation since its existence. And when you look at the Arab Spring, when you look at Egypt, 70 million people, no longer a toady of the United States and of Israel. When you look at Turkey, when you look at what's happening at the UN, Israel is isolated. And so how that will work out in Netanyahu's computations, that's really an interesting question. I don't know exactly. But one big incentive would be to show the world that even though we, Israel, are isolated, we have the sole remaining superpower in the world at our beck and call. Look, they're supporting our attack on Iran. So I hope that doesn't happen. That's about all I can say right now. But I want to really do some dialogue here. And please don't get the idea that I think I have a corner on the analysis here, because many of my friends are much more relaxed. Many of my friends think that this is all bluff. I can't think it's all bluff. And I think even I are a little more relaxed now, because over the last 2 weeks, with the statements that have come out of the White House, and now this very demonstrative gesture saying, no, we're just as soon. The president's too busy to meet with the prime minister of Israel. I think that will speak volumes, and I hope indeed that will give Netanyahu some pause. Now, if he's unwilling to meet with me when I'm in the United States, how can I be sure he'll come to my aid if I start a war with Iran? So that's about it. Thanks for your attention to the degree you're still awake. And I'd be happy to engage in whatever dialogue you'd like.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ray. I have a question, and then maybe after that we'll open it up just for anyone else that wants to unmute their phone and ask you a question or mm-hmm. contribute something to the discussion. My question, following along with trying to put ourselves in the shoes of Netanyahu and mm-hmm. the neocons in Israel and here, there are really two ways that they could accomplish their goal of getting the U.S. to attack Iran and effectively militarily destroy it. One would be, as we've been discussing, for Israel to launch an attack on the assumption that the U.S. would get drawn into it. The other way is essentially what they have been doing now for years, which is to get the U.S. to keep putting more and more pressure and getting closer and closer to the brink of war with Iran, and to the point where the United States will attack Iran in a way that Israel cannot be blamed for. That is to say that it would not start with some action by the Israelis. And if I was in Netanyahu's shoes, That would be infinitely preferable, especially considering what you said about the isolation that Israel is experiencing. And this kind of goes along with some of the other analysis. In particular, yesterday Netanyahu told the Canadian Broadcasting Company that essentially what he is looking for is an agreement with the U.S. on a red line for attacking Iran. That is to say that the United States would embrace something the Israelis would approve in terms of essentially saying, if the Iranians do this, we will attack. And Gareth Porter's written in a couple of articles that in fact is the Israeli goal in all of this threat and bluff and whatever it is, that essentially to get the U.S. to establish a red line, get the U.S. to say, if Iran does X, Y, or Z, the United States will attack it. What do you think of that that way of looking at it?
Well, as I think you know, Gareth Porter is one of my favorite people. He's a neighbor, and we collaborate on much of this. On this, we tend to disagree. You know, I guess it was Senator Moynihan who said everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts, okay? Now, the facts are that both our Secretary of Defense and the Israeli Defense Minister have stated on the open record that Iran is not working on a nuclear weapon. They did this in January, and as you know, the Intelligence Committee, the intelligence community, has remained steadfast in resisting pressure to change that judgment. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that when Obama gets up and says, you know, we will not tolerate a nuclear weapon in Iran's hands, and when Netanyahu gets up and he says, we don't think anyone should tolerate a nuclear weapons capability in Iranians' hands, well, you know, I'm all for textual analysis. But when you talk about a nuclear capability, well, Japan has one. Many countries have a nuclear capability. Anybody who has nuclear power stations has a capability of turning their technology within the space of several months into a nuclear weapons development process, okay? So I see the obfuscation here as being deliberate, and people tend to make a big deal out of the difference between a nuclear weapon and a nuclear weapons capability, but I think the American president and our government is very clear that they will resist any evidence, or they will resist if they see evidence that Iran is working on a nuclear weapon. And Leon Panetta says, are the Iranians working on a nuclear weapon? No. And that's a direct quote. Now, Netanyahu can make all the noise he wants about, now you got to make it a nuclear weapons capability. But I see that as just so much rhetoric. What he's trying to do is get something for nothing. He's trying to say, okay, maybe we won't strike out at Iran, but hey, you have to be more specific. You have to adopt our line. If they get a nuclear weapons capability, then yeah, that's the red line. Well, you know, it's all surreal. It's all surreal, Nick, because they already have a nuclear weapons capability in the same terms that Japan has, okay? So I don't really see this as a serious I like the textual analysis. I used to do Sovietology. So I think there's great merit in this, but the real deal here has to do with whether Netanyahu thinks that he can get away with provoking a war with Iran. Up until now, at least, he has convinced himself that, yes, he could, that Obama certainly would. You know, I checked with George Washington University Hospital here in Portland. Not perfected a backbone implant yet, okay? And Marlon is not going to be able to avail himself of that kind of operation. I'm not be able to. And I regret to say that I think, up until now at least, Netanyahu has been right in that calculation. Right now, with Dempsey's remark, with Obama refusing to them, I think those are where the game is. It's not a rhetoric about, you know, if Obama to say, okay, nuclear capability, well, what good is that going to do when Obama wins a second term? I mean, promise like that is something that Obama will feel compelled to honor. Give me a break. Once he's a second term president, he's free to a lot of things. He's really not. And as a last thought here, if you think back to Jimmy Carter's run for a second term, the Israelis, for precisely the same reasons, did everything they possibly could to sabotage. Why? Because under King David, the Israelis agreed to do something constructive. And it clear to them that, all right, you to really bear down. We not only have treaties, we have some decent.
Oh, God.
Ray,
I've got to cut
your
in
your phone's
here.
Breaking up. I think maybe you better call in back in.
No, what I have to cut in here on is we have to be against all nuclear weapons on the face of this earth. You know, that's
right.
What PDA has to stand for. And that's what we have to work for.
And that's what the Iranians and the third world countries, the non-aligned movement called for just 10 days ago. So that's, you know, when you talk about a nuclear-free Middle East, that's a great idea. And the fly in the ointment there is clearly Israel that has 200, 300 nuclear weapons.
America has to lead that charge to end all nuclear weapons on this planet. And this is what our government has not done. And this is where I really fault Obama in giving up on stopping the charge for ending nuclear weapons on the face of the earth. This is something that Kennedy did. You know, as you read about the history of our presidents in the past, this is what we have to do.
Well, that would be great. It's, the ideal solution, and indeed the Non-Proliferation Treaty calls for a reduction in the armaments and nuclear weapons of those that already possess them. So, to the degree people hold up the NPT as the paragon of virtue and want to enforce that, well, it's already been sort of dismissed by the nuclear powers because they have not lived up to their part of the bargain.
Can we ask a question? Am I heard?
Sure.
Yep, yeah. We can hear you.
Okay, hi. Jeff from Vermont. I'd like to bring a slightly different dynamic into this, and I have to use a phrase that hopefully everyone can grasp. But when we talk about empire and imperialistic empire, from Dwight Eisenhower's comments about the military-industrial complex, and the similar comments from Lincoln and Roosevelt and several other presidents. This imperialistic empire, really is a nation in themselves above nations. So could you make your comments about Iran and Israel in the context of these global powers? I'm sure there's some independent actions as well. But I think we need to start to look at a lot of things in terms of nuclear weapons and in terms of Iran and any other issues that we're facing in terms of what I like to label the imperialistic empire, because they're a power that actually has already done a coup d'etat in our government. We're controlled by corporations and money-powered interests. Could you comment on your rephrase some of your comments in that context, if you could?
Sure. Was it Mike?
No, Jeff.
Sure.
Jeff from
No, Jack. Okay, be happy to do that. The military industrial congressional media intelligence security complex is thriving these days on all these commitments, and Israel is one of their favorite babies. You know, $3 billion a year, that's a lot of loot, okay? That's a lot of proceeds to the Lockheeds of this world. So that part is going just fine for the corporations that you mentioned, and it's what Eisenhower predicted and warned against in spades. Now, when I was on active duty with the CIA, so to speak, it made a certain amount of sense when we feared Soviet encroachments in the Arab world to strengthen the, once it was called, our battleship in the Eastern Mediterranean, namely Israel, okay? Once the Soviet Union imploded, you know, I began to wonder, well, won't there be repercussions here with respect to how much we need Israel? And, you know, I'm no Middle Eastern specialist here, but I was sort of surprised to see that no. The political realities in this country are such that Israel will always enjoy favorite nation treatment, despite what George Washington, our first president, warned against in terms of a passionate attachment to another country whose goals really do not match our own. So what I see here is the empire trying to hang on to this battleship in the Eastern Mediterranean, and the whole thing strikes me as incredibly feckless because history is not on our side here. Egypt Spring, the Cairo Spring, certainly showed that. And to the degree that we, out of our interest in oil, prop up regimes like the Saudis, interest in navies, prop up regimes like the one in Bahrain, we're on the wrong side of history. And sooner or later, it's going to redound to our unbenefit, so to speak, and we're going to be, the chickens are going to come home to roost. So that would be my gloss on what I think was your question, Jack.
Well, it's Jeff, on the wrong side of history. I mean, we now look back and know one of the main motives, and I know this might be an oversimplification for going to Iraq, was oil. We're in Afghanistan, this is $1 trillion of natural mineral resources. So most of what we're doing has to do with water, natural resources, minerals, also in Africa and all over the world. So I would take a guess, and it's only a guess, that whether something happens in Iran or not will really be based on whether the imperialistic empire interests, okay, can profit from it, or there's resources they want to control. Is there any viability to that kind of thinking?
Well, yeah. You know, I think when you look at Iraq and when you go back to after 9/11 and see how things were done, many of you will remember that at the first National Security Council meeting after the election in 2000, Bush made it very clear that he was going to go after Iraq. Now, this is long before 9/11. Condoleezza Rice had George Tenet, the head of the CIA, come up with some grainy photos which showed an installation in Iraq, and Tenet said, well, yeah, we think that might be a chemical weapons, it might be a chemical weapons factory, you know, and somebody asked him, was there any confirmation of that? No, there's no confirmation. It kind of looks like it. Well, there wasn't any, of course, but this was all just to get the discussion going on Iraq. At the next NSC meeting, and we have Paul O'Neill, who was the Secretary of the Treasury at the time, reporting with great wonderment how the maps of Iraq were set out on the table, various sectors were allocated to this or that Western oil company with the prospect of them cashing in once we had done in Saddam Hussein. So oil was obviously the reason Why, that region, oil and natural gas and water are the most important part of that. That's why we went into Iraq. Oil, the permanent bases that are necessary to defend that kind of thing, or at least project our power, and Israel. Israel was a big cheerleader for that. Now, in this case, with respect to Iran, it's not so much the oil. It's not so much permanent military bases. It's, in my view, 75% Israel, pure and simple. And I think the American people need to know that, because there's no reason on God's earth that Iran poses any threat to us, much less to Israel. And once people know that, if Israel strikes out at Iran, what I fear most is the blowback here. You talk about anti-Semitism. I think it's a terrible thing. But once you tell the American people that our kids are getting killed because of a war that Israel started, then you got real, real problems, and I would hate to see that day.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, on those lines, how do we deal with this in context of the election? What would you recommend?
Well, I think what we need to do is spread as much truth around as we can. People get a free pass. The mainstream media is so totally corrupted that it seems to me the only thing we have is what I call the fifth estate, the fourth estate being moribund. The fifth estate, which is in the ether, which is not susceptible to easy control, and which we can spread the word around. And it has to be done by people like us, with our neighbors, with our associates. We have to call these people on this. If Romney says that he's going to, that Romney has said that if Israel attacks Iran, he would support that. Well, that needs to be challenged, my God. And the mainstream media is not going to challenge that. So it's up to us. Now, the good news is there are enough of us. You know, Cesar Chavez used to always be faced with the complaint, you know, that, oh, well, there aren't enough of us. He said, there are enough of us. There are always enough of us. But what we have to do is not limit ourselves to speeches and interviews and papers. We need to get out in the streets. We need to put our bodies into them, because without action, nothing is going to happen. I see that as the realistic attitude here. And I see this as a crucial time to raise these issues. And if they don't raise them in the presidential debates, well, we should write in there the day after saying, why didn't they talk about this? Because this is what's going to get us into real trouble.
What do you think about what happened at the Democratic Convention, where the agenda was changed?
You mean about Jerusalem?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's really awful. I mean, if you saw the play-by-play, which
awful.
I didn't, but I've read about.
I did.
I mean, this is not, I haven't seen anybody refer to this, but this is not the first time that this happened. If you recall, as soon as Obama was nominated, the neocons and the Zionists, among his retinue there, including Rahm Emanuel, they told him to say that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel.
Yeah.
And he did. And then 2 days later, he said, oh, I didn't really mean that. Now, no one was ever held accountable for that. I don't know whether it was Dennis Ross or Rahm Emanuel or who put that into his speech, but they did, and they got away scot-free with it. Obama was embarrassed because it's against all the international agreements. And
I can barely hear right now.
Yeah. Well, he retracted his statement, and that was very embarrassing. And somebody, when they put that into a president's speech or even a president-elect speech, they should be held accountable, and they're not. And that's part of the real problem. We need to hold them accountable.
Well, this is Sandy. I think just leading on to, you know, what PDA can do and what we as PDA members can do, next week will be our monthly brown bag lunch vigils at congressional offices around the country. And one of the things we're going to be asking of them is to support
Barbara Lee's bill, H.R. 4173, I think it is, which would require the president to appoint a high-level negotiator to open up serious negotiations with Iran over our, you know, going, I think, beyond the nuclear question, but to really the whole bilateral relationship. So that is one, just one thing that we can do that I hope a lot of you will be doing next week.
Sandy, could I break in with a question here?
Sure.
There was some legislation that would forbid any U.S. official from talking to any Iranian official. I've lost track. Has that been passed?
I believe that was passed, yeah. This would effectively overturn that if this bill were to pass. Yeah, I mean, it's a pushback against that.
Yeah. I guess the one thought I have is that citizen-to-citizen initiatives could make a difference here. Barbara Lee, I admire more than anybody else in Congress, but she's not going to make much of an impact in that Zionist-controlled Congress. We need to think of imaginative ways that we can go over to Iran or that we can go to the UN representation there in New York and talk to these folks directly rather than think we have to go through this corrupt body that is now called the Congress.
Well, thank you so much.
Sandy, can I jump in?
Sure.
I'm sorry, just real quick. I was hoping that Sandy could respond to that comment. Mike Fox here in Florida. Sandy actually has an incredible list of victories in dealing with his congressperson. Sandy, would you care to weigh in on that?
Well, yeah, we've definitely had some good progress. We've been doing our brown bag lunch vigils at Frederica Wilson's office since she was elected in 2010. And, you know, the first thing we asked her was to become a member of the Progressive Caucus, which she did. And then the next thing right behind that was asking her to sign on to H.R. 780, which is Barbara Lee's bill, to cut off the funding for the war in Afghanistan and fund only the withdrawal of all U.S. forces. And so really, I mean, we just kept hammering away, going month after month and talking to the staff there. And finally, on our last visit in August, she agreed to sign on to that. So she has now become the 70-somethings representative to sign on to that bill. She also signed on to a couple of other bills we'd been lobbying them on Citizens United and an emergency jobs bill. And, you know, this is, I don't think this is any kind of silver bullet, but this is one thing that we can do. And for us, it was very heartening to see that after really feeling that we were banging our heads on a brick wall there month after month, that she finally did agree to sign on to those bills. And I would have to say that she signed on to H.R. 780 the day after the Veterans for Peace National Convention ended in Miami. And so I don't think that was for nothing either. But, you know, Part of what we do with PDA is to engage with our members of Congress and try to get them, you know, from wherever each one of them stands, to try and hold their feet to the fire and get them to do the right thing on these kind of issues. And, you know, and I guess we were just glad to celebrate a small victory there.
All right, so right there, the proof is in the pudding. We got to keep pushing these people to agree with us and sign on to the legislation we're asking for.
So we're coming awfully close to the top of the hour. And I would just sort of like to beg the people, if you can stay on through when it says the recording has stopped, which I think was going to happen in a couple minutes,
we really hope to hear from people on the call who they are and what they do in your home territory on anti-war measures. So I hope some of you will be able to stay on and tell us that.
So,
anyone
want to
start?
Well, and let's just first really thank Ray very much for giving us so much time.
Thank you.
And, you know, you're welcome to stay on, Ray, and, you know, continue chatting with us. But, you know, if you want to go, obviously, that's fine, too. And we really, really appreciate you doing this tonight.
Yes, we do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ray.
Yes. Who's that?
Thank you, Ray.
Right. Does anyone want to say their name and a little bit about what they do in their own town or city or about such things as war in Afghanistan or Iran?
And I'd like to know if anybody has things planned for October 7th for the anniversary of Afghanistan war.
Exactly.
This is Kate Walsh from Chicago. And I'm new to this group, and I've been working against war since, oh my gosh, over 40 years. And I'm an educator and a registered nurse. I do pro bono case management for people who are stuck in the healthcare system. I've been trying to work on behalf of the veterans, which we haven't been making much headway here in town. We can't seem to get things coordinated very well in this area. These young veterans slip through our fingers. We can't find them. We don't know. I don't really know what to do next. I'm working on ideas and I'm open for suggestions. I train to work with the Soldiers Project, and I'm all set and ready to go, but that hasn't happened either. We're trying to get that up and running again. Been involved with military families since the very beginning, and we are now, I guess, essentially morphed with United for Peace and Justice, which is great because it's another thing I've been advocating for many years, is that so many of the peace and justice groups are running in parallel tracks, which makes us very weak in comparison to the right wing. I have a son who's being deployed to Afghanistan as of October 1, and I can't imagine it because he was radiation poisoned in Bush 41's war and is not well, can't gain weight, has chronic GI problems and chronic migraine headaches, and so I don't know what's going to happen there. So as you can imagine, on the personal and global level, I am very motivated, and I'm really pleased and honored to be part of this group and hope to learn more and keep going. As far as what's going on here in town, I have heard nothing about anything that's going on in town, and I'm also up to my eyelashes with the Chicago teacher strike. My husband's a Chicago teacher, and he is the union delegate for
Solidarity.
His school. Thank you. So we are toe-to-toe with Mr. Emanuel, the neocon of all neocons, and, well, I guess not of all neocons, but he's right up there with them. And so we are very hopeful that we are going to be able to make some headway here, not just for the Chicago schools, but for all workers who are under siege from this horrid, horrid neoconservative agenda that was implanted about 1970 and has gained momentum very seriously since 2000. So that's who I am, and I, in a nutshell, and I'm, again, very grateful to all of you, and we will carry on.
That was an inspirational story. Mike Fox here down in St. Petersburg. Can I jump
Thank
in here
you.
Real quick?
Sure.